This is Dr. David Black, founding director of the American Mindfulness Research Association. I speak a second time with guest Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and creator of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program, also known as MBSR. He is the author of many leading mindfulness meditation books. Full Catastrophe Living is the classic MBSR manual, and it has been published in 10 languages. Over 700 medical centers.
More like 14 or 17 now.
So we're going up. All right, 14. Yeah. We'll put 14 out there. Over 700 medical centers and clinics use the MBSR model. Dr. Kabat-Zinn, welcome and so happy to have you back. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, David. It's really nice to be back with you.
So let's continue our conversation. So we had a conversation that's posted on our website, episode 7, about your pioneering research on the MBSR program. We examined its development, the concept, how you bridged that with routine clinical care as part of like a referral system to a pain clinic. We explored pain as an important model for applying a program like MBSR. And you were telling me at the time it even had a different name. See, I didn't even know this. I always refer to the program as MBSR. Do you want to speak about how the evolution of even a name was working for you in the 1970s and you were publishing with various names?
Yeah, well, in 1979, when I started the stress reduction clinic, I actually called it the stress reduction and relaxation program. It seemed like that was a kind of a good enough umbrella to get people interested. And we used to put up signs in the hospital because we didn't have any like permanent signage at the beginning. So I would go around with these arrows that I put up on the wall, and then these signs saying stress reduction with an arrow. And people who work there would say to me, like, I'm just find myself walking around the halls following those stress reduction arrows. Where is it? I need stress reduction. And this is back in 1979 when, you know, from the perspective of 2021, you could say, what, 1979, what stress? You know, the world is so much more complicated now and crazy and, you know, digital and, you know, sort of information bubbles and, you know, a tremendous animosity, you know, says the coin of the realm. So if there was a need for stress reduction in 1979, it's just like, you know, compounded exponentially to the present moment. So it started out as what we called the SR and RP program, stress reduction and relaxation program. And it wasn't until the sort of, I think, mid-90s that I felt like I needed to call it what it really was, which was mindfulness-based stress reduction, because other people were claiming to be doing stress reduction. And so it was too generic to just say stress reduction and relaxation program. And you have to remember that in 1979, in the early 80s, the idea of bringing meditation and mindful hatha yoga into the mainstream of a medical center, an academic medical center, was like, you know, considered to be insane and highly threatening of all the, you know, academic standards of rationality and so forth. So it was a very audacious thing to do, and how one languages something like that becomes really important so that you minimize the potential pushback or antipathy about it and actually maximize a kind of interest, you know, like stress reduction. Everybody's interested in stress reduction. And so that's, you can see that progression in the scientific papers, that I don't actually use the term MBSR until sometime in the mid-1990s. But it was always the same thing. And, but when I went back and started reading the papers that some of which we may talk about now in this session, there were certain ways that I expressed things that I would not be expressing them that way now. For instance, here's one. I use the word technique to describe the various practices that we would introduce in MBSR. And at a certain point in the late 80s, I started to realize that it was a big mistake to use the word technique, because people think of a technique in a particular way, and then it's just something you learn and then you do it. And then anybody can pick up the technique and teach it. And this is much more of an art form than it is a kind of auto mechanics model of fixing. And so it needs a different kind of languaging. But it took decades for me to find my own comfort level in terms of how to best couch it, because the word practice or meditation practice would not have been understood in the late 70s and early 80s, because people only think of practice as kind of like in relationship to, say, practicing a musical instrument or a sport of some kind or other. And so to practice meditation had to create a certain kind of atmosphere of in which it could be understood. And that took, it's a cultural shift. They're shifting the bell curve in a certain way culturally within medicine. And it took a while for that to come about. So that was one. The other is that I shuddered to find that I used the term detached awareness, okay, or detached attention, I think it was. And although there were footnotes in the papers that commented on detachment and how it shouldn't be misunderstood as kind of depersonalization or disassociation, non-attachment is a much, much better way to frame it. But non-attachment in those days would have just been too hard for people to read. So I had to try to find out, in a certain sense, where the field was at, and then interface my language in such a way that I could describe what we were doing in ways that would be understood by the mainstream. And then gradually over time, it was basically a strategy to move the bell curve in the direction of relanguaging even pathology. You know, like, we don't consider anxiety and depression to actually be pathological. They're just kind of conditions that can be approached in different kinds of ways. If you tend to pathologize everything, then it gives, you know, much more the sense that there's nothing can be done by me. It's just the experts that understand it, and whatever drugs or surgery they can apply, then I become a passive recipient of treatment instead of an active participant. So it's a whole kind of universe that required an evolution. And of course, I was a part of it. It's not like I understood what I understand now. Back then, I was like, my own meditation practice was also developing and trying to find the most skillful ways to express something that would be really understandable, say, in a Buddhist meditation center. But if you're not in that kind of environment, then you can't use those kinds of words without creating a kind of deep understanding or framework for that kind of understanding. And that took decades to kind of relanguage these very ancient meditation practices and the classical vocabulary that's used to describe them, including words like non-duality and, you know, sort of. So that's basically what can be read between the lines if you are interested in the kind of historical arc of this whole thing.
Interesting
for me to see my own, you know, almost every sentence is a solution to a certain kind of problem.
It is. And so I have a major interest in the history of science. So I'm very interested. And the word itself, history of something, sounds a little boring, but it's very interesting when you think of it in terms of how do good ideas, such as the one you had, like come into being. It's not a snap of the finger, which from an outsider's perspective and from a young trainee in the sciences, they'll see these events of, oh, they just knew it. They were so smart and it just came to them. But this isn't really, from my understanding, how that horizon of scientific progress is made. It is exactly like you are saying, and that's why I love your case example as a beautiful point. It's meeting avenues and then having new insights, making corrections, being curious about what you've done in the past may not be the perfect languaging or not what you envisioned, and being willing, and this is the hardest part, being courageous enough to be like, okay, I am going to put the word on it, right? And that's also a really hard part. It takes an individual to do it. And sometimes all of us in our scientific careers will get that feeling like, oh, I just can't do it. It's not ready. I can't meet this innovation with courage. And so this example you're giving are those important and pivotal moments that people do not see. They just see the program and they just expect it was packaged as a done deal. And so was there any more of those moments that you, like the career of a scientist, and especially having this amazing opportunity that your mind was able with its environment to create this beautiful program that evolved, any other like scientific moments where it's like, these are the hard points, the transition points to bringing something to the next level? Because ultimately you did. And ultimately,
well, one or two come to mind. Yeah. And it's not just language. It's really a question of how to reach people in their hearts and motivate them to engage in their own trajectory through life, including at the level of the stress, the pain, and the illness that they might be experiencing. So when it came to pain, long before I started the stress reduction clinic and MBSR, I was sitting a fairly intensive 2-week meditation retreat late March, I think, or early April, in what was during the summer a Girl Scout camp. So it was a summer cabins with no heating whatsoever, and we were sitting. I was sitting in the morning in my, sort of my cabin or in the meditation hall, absolutely freezing. And for long stretches of time, several hours at a time. And I ran into levels of pain. And every meditator knows this. If you've ever been on a meditation retreat, a fairly rigorous meditation retreat, you might actually even take vows not to move for a particular a period of time, not to move intentionally, just to see what happens when we kind of narrow the conditions a little bit to experiment with what the mind will do when it can't so easily do what it usually does. So here I am sitting early in the morning, freezing. And also my knees absolutely killing me because I've been sitting for quite some time. And I, of course, if I got up, the pain would go away right away. So you know that if you get up, the pain's going to go away, but you stay there anyway. And I had the experience of at a certain moment, what I was calling pain, just evaporating, and it just became impersonal sensation, not my pain. And that's true for the cold too, that it was just, and time fell away. And this was something that happened, more and more and more, the more deeply I got into the retreat and into the meditation practice. But the reason I'm telling it to you is that I thought, well, this is very interesting. I can get up and the pain will go away. And here I am sitting in it and through it. And all of a sudden I have a new way of being in relationship to it. And it's no longer pain. It's bare sensation. And then, I've got you know, thoughts about it, and I've got an emotional reactivity around it. But none of that is actually the pain, but it is certainly compounding my anxiety and my suffering. But when I felt that, when I experienced it, I thought, well, what about people who can't just get up and have it go away? What about people who live with chronic pain after automobile accidents or industrial accidents or whatever the cause? And they are living in a body that sometimes feels like it's on fire and unrelenting. This might be a way, because there's not that much that can be done for people like that. Even the drugs often don't work. But even if the drugs do work, they have their own side effects and problems. What if we could train people to actually put the welcome mat out for what was most unwanted in my experience at the present moment, particularly chronic pain conditions, and see if there's not another way to be in relationship to it, where we're not trying to make it go away, we're not trying to fix it, we're not trying to suppress it. We're in some sense learning to experiment and investigate the nature of it and see if there isn't some other way that it's possible to hold the experience so that there may be pain, but there won't be suffering. And that was a strong motivator for actually talking to the people in the pain clinic when I, you know, was working at UMass and in the orthopedic clinic, where they also deal with a lot of pain. And the response that I was getting from the directors of both of those clinics is, I can think of 100 people right off the top of my head who could really benefit from anything you could offer them besides what we have to offer them, because what we have to offer them is actually very, very limited. And in most cases, we can't help them all that much. It's not like there are 10 cures on the shelf for these chronic pain conditions, whether it's back pain or neck pain or shoulder pain or whatever it is. So that was one of the major kind of incentives for starting the stress reduction clinic and inviting people to actually learn these meditative practices that are basically putting out the welcome mat for your own experience, good, bad, or ugly, and seeing if one couldn't be in wiser relationship to it, not to get through anything, but to actually discover a new way of being in wise relationship with the unwanted. And it turns out that when people are at the end of their rope, as many people would say they were, they take to this like ducks to water, because they've tried everything else. And then they discover that they have the whole armamentarium of a human body, mind, brain, heart, and it's a complex universe of its own. And so while pain may be, you know, unavoidable in certain circumstances, pain isn't exactly the congruent of suffering, that the pain is there, but the suffering has to do with how we choose to respond to it, how we choose to react to it, whether we understand there's a difference between reacting and responding and befriending. And all of these things come straight out of the meditation practice. So those were some of the threads that, you know, led me to believe that it was a valid thing to do, and would rather than be harmful to people, because it also was like weird to bring meditation and yoga into the mainstream of a medical center. Nobody had ever done it before, but it seemed like suffering is a good reason to stretch the envelope, to try to help people, especially when the armamentarium is limited in certain domains. And then to loop back to what we were talking about, then we have to use words to try to put this whole thing in a context that anybody can understand at the level of an individual person, patient, And also then if you're going to be writing up the results of this in first descriptive and then more, comparative trial-based studies, how do you language this so that people will actually understand the depth of it and how it can sit within the larger field of whatever that field is, which is why I started using the vocabulary of self-regulation, because lots of people were talking about self-regulation in the 70s and early 80s. Now I almost never talk about self-regulation. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I'm much more interested in the self part and who we think we are and how our narratives about self are so constricting and restricting compared to the full potentiality and dimensionality of a human being.
Yeah, so your choice of the term self-regulation at the time, I think, is another important marker about the history of science and how that arc works. We don't know at any one given time the best way to describe a phenomena, but we can borrow from the language that's currently agreed on, right? So the behavioral sciences, 1970s and 80s, self-regulation, it sounds like was a very popular term. This was the target mechanism by which when you deliver a behavioral intervention, we just assume people become better neural and sensory regulators, right? And so it made sense to this model, like person learns to relax, they're self-regulating sensory activity, they're self-regulating their thoughts. And in doing so, that goes into a black box of change, and then they come out better than they were before. So what your use of that term at the time, and it sounded like you were bridging, because you have to do this in the history of science. You know, there are moments when you have to make decisions about terms. And we didn't yet know the complexity of the language that you ended up evolving during the last 40 years. But at the time, what did self-regulation mean to you?
Yeah. Well, that was also the time of what was called self-efficacy and the work that Bandura was doing at Stanford. And it has to do with a sense of agency, you know. So this was like radical stuff in the 70s and 80s. Now, participation on the part of the patient is kind of axiomatic within the NIH, universe. But the idea that the patient would participate in the medical trajectory, it's really like it was revolutionary back then. I mean, it was more like, we're the experts. We know what's wrong with you. We'll diagnose you. We'll treat you. All you have to do is be a passive recipient and an active kind of inactive adherence to whatever we prescribe for you or tell you to do. And this was more like saying, there's a whole other dimension here, which is the more you can align with what the intentions of your healthcare team are, and that you can do things for yourself that no one else on the planet can do for you. And one of them is to learn how to inhabit the full sort of multidimensional universe of your body and your mind and your social network. Long before there was ever a, sort of digital social network or social media. So this was radical stuff, but you're getting at the point that this is always happening. Now the vocabulary that I've developed needs to be developed again and again and again. And all sorts of, issues come up that, I tried very hard, if you read those early papers, to look at like, who are we missing? And are we just getting people to say that it's great, but it's not really great? Are they just telling us that they got good pain reduction or pain regulation because they were pleasing us? And so I really tried to analyze the people who didn't respond to our questionnaires and to get to them to respond and to talk with them. And then to also see whether 4 years later in follow-up that what happened in 8 weeks, 4 years ago was still meaningful. And are you still actually practicing any of the stuff that you picked up in those 8 weeks. And the general sense of it was that doing these follow-up studies and so forth is that people were touched by something. It's really hard to put into words. Were they all meditating 45 minutes a day, 6 days a week, the way they were during those 8 weeks? No, but the program was never designed to have them meditate in that way for the rest of their lives. It was designed to touch them in multiple ways so that they would actually meditate for the rest of their lives, but their way, not my way. And then how much time you spend on the cushion or with a particular kind of practice is only a part of the equation, because the real meditation practice is how you live your life moment by moment by moment. So it's everyday life, so to speak, and how you are in relationship with your body and with, you know, the entire field of sensory awareness, sounds, and then thoughts and emotions and sensations of all kinds, and then interaction with the world of nature and other people and community and family. So it was kind of like the intersecting of two worlds, this world that I did not make up, but was like thousands of years old, meditative traditions, contemplative practices meant to be freeing from the conditions of life that often are highly oppressive or painful and could generate enormous amounts of suffering. So that's the stream of contemplative practices, ancient ones from Taoism and Buddhism and the yoga tradition and the Vedanta traditions and all of these various wisdom traditions. And there are many all over the world on all continents. So I just made use of the ones that I had the most familiarity with. And then on the other hand, science, the confluence, it's like, sometimes I describe it as rivers converging, but they were more like glaciers coming together. And then gradually coming together, the glacier of science with the glacier of contemplative wisdom. And now, of course, it's not glaciers at all. All the glaciers are melted and it's torrents. But this is the first time on the planet that these two different, very serious and very kind of rigorous ways of knowing, epistemologies, have converged, and it's generating not just new language, but it's generating new possibilities for understanding what the brain is, what tranquility means, what self-confidence means, what embodied presence means, and how these influence health. For instance, mental health, physical health, social health, planetary health. So medicine is in some sense just at the right moment, I think, gone from what we've learned over the past several hundred years or 50 or 60 years of, you know, sort of molecular medicine, so to speak, to planetary medicine, that we need to put our stethoscope on the planet, you know, whether it's a thermometer or whether it's a saltometer, you know, or whatever it is, that the, you know, the salinity of the ocean is being affected, that the glaciers are melting, that temperatures are rising. And so it would be absurd for us not to develop a medicine for our home, because you can't be healthy in a polluted, sick environment. And, you know, that's something that I think is so much more in evidence now and is a much larger group of people who accept that now than did, say, in the 1970s or 80s.
And to do that, you have to gain buy-in, and you are able to do this. So I think an additional concept that's important for people to see how science evolves, there's moments when you get buy-in from a broader system. So you had a broader system at play. You had a pain clinic, and it seemed to, at that moment, match to a program that you had developed. For a person who wants to innovate,
it wasn't just it's so hard to talk about these things in a way that's like really accurate. There was a pain clinic there, and I did visit the head of the pain clinic and actually published a few papers with him, because we collaborated on whether mindfulness could actually, and stress reduction could be helpful to pain reduction, so to speak. But there were all these other things also going on at the same time. So it wasn't just about the pain clinic. It was that I think doctors all universally felt like there are the people I help and then there are the people I don't know what to do with. And I don't know whether it's me, or I don't know whether it's my armamentarium of what I have to offer. And I don't know whether it's the resistance or noncompliance on the part of the patient, but there's a certain subset of my patients I can't help. And the idea was to create a clinic where the doctors would be motivated to send all those people that they didn't know what to do with, no matter what their diagnosis was, to the stress reduction clinic, to the MBSR clinic. And then we would challenge them to do what they could for themselves in a participatory kind of way, as a complement to whatever the healthcare system could or could not do for them. So it satisfied a huge amount of stress on the part of the physician population at UMass, because they actually then had a service that they could refer people to when they just didn't want to deal with this person anymore, or didn't know how else to be helpful. And then we'd say, the first thing we would say to them is, by the way, you're referred for this, this, and this. It says on your referral and all these diagnoses. Truth be told, we can't help you with any of it. But this is a clinic in the form of a course that's designed to teach you what might be possible to help yourself, to see if there's not some way in which you can mobilize the intrinsic capacities of your mind and body to learn and grow and heal and transform over 8 weeks. And we'll just see. I mean, what do you have to lose in a certain kind of way? But we're going to study this as rigorously as we can from a scientific point of view, because this may be one of the missing ingredients in medicine that patients need to participate much, much more, because every body is a universe of trillion inconceivable numbers of atoms, molecules, and then all organized for self-regulation. And very little of it is actually understood. But if we could optimize, or at least recruit, those capacities that we take for granted, like our capacity to just be present, to pay attention, to hold uncomfortable sensations in awareness and see what happens when we watch. And then what are our thoughts doing? What are our emotions doing? What are our degrees of freedom in not just kind of getting up and screaming and running away to the medicine cabinet? That was the kind of context in which we started to create a kind of an adventure in exploration that was integral to what can I do for myself that nobody else in medicine is going to be able to do. And then we work in tandem, as in a complementary way, and then try to write about it in a language that people won't just immediately scoff at or dismiss. So you have to find the right way to actually resonate with the late language, as we were talking about earlier, that's being used at that present moment. Self-regulation, well, that sounds kind of scientific, you know? Paying attention, paying attention. At least there's nothing weird or mystical about paying attention. If you start to use yoga, meditation, well, we have to bring people along before they can use the words yoga and meditation. Now, that whole thing has happened. Nobody thinks of yoga as like, I mean, everybody's doing it. You know, everybody's doing it. And if they're not doing it, they don't think badly of it. They think like, I should probably be doing it. And the same with meditation in a certain way. And it's an ongoing evolution. So as I was saying, the vocabulary continues to have to change. This was a point that I wanted to make earlier. What about the people who fall through the cracks of the MBSR program? Or are we harming anybody? You know, because those are also important things. And we bent over backwards to ask people, you know, how are they doing on scales with, you know, that where it, getting worse was fine. I mean, if you were getting worse, we wanted to know about it. It wasn't like we were creating a social set of conditions where you could only say this was helpful to me. And so we really paid a lot of attention to the people who didn't respond to our questionnaires or who said that they're excuse me, or who said that their pain was getting worse over the course of the 8 weeks and so forth, and really connected with them both on a heart level, person to person, and also in terms of the kinds of things they were filling out on their outcome questionnaires and so forth. So we didn't drop people if they weren't doing well. And a lot of people, I would ask them, they said their pain was getting worse. I remember this very, very clearly. I would ask people, well, why are you still coming? You know, on all the measures that we're taking, you're like, what, you know, not doing well here. You're getting worse and worse. Why are you coming? Why do you keep coming to class? Why do you keep meditating? And they say things like, well, I don't know, but it just feels like I belong here. So there were all sorts of other things happening that maybe they weren't aware of or could articulate. And in 8 weeks, though, they felt like they belonged. They were part of the class. They wanted to hear what other people's lives were like. So it was a kind of social dimension of like shared pain and suffering and also shared intentionality to bring mindfulness in whatever ways we could to transform it. And so I never thought that it was eight weeks and that was it. You know, if you didn't get it in 8 weeks, mindfulness would never be of use to you. That was just kind of like a launching platform. But if even the seed was planted, maybe 2 or 3 years down the road, you'd come back. And we saw a lot of people in our inner city clinic where we were dealing with all sorts of cultural problems of different kinds as well, or challenges, not problems. We'd see people come back 3, 4, 5 times to take the program over and over again, especially if they dropped out the first 2 or 3 or 4 times. So I think in terms of damage, I think we've done minimum damage to, and we paid attention to this in a very, very high level on an individual level, not just averages. That we like really cared what people's experience was, no matter what it was, and then tried to document that the fact that it seemed like almost everybody was benefiting in one way or another, and even the people who seemed to be failing in one way were benefiting in other ways, but I didn't have necessarily the means or even the understanding available to wrap my mind around what that was. But part of it, I think, was the sense of social connection.
So what you're talking about here is an important element of what we continue to study today with all of our behavioral programs in the behavioral sciences, which is either we call it various things, but either compliance to the program or adherence to whatever protocol or program we're putting in place. So I'm looking at your 1986 paper. It was the follow-up when you were still using the SR and RP program name. So if people are interested in that, they could check it out. And looking at these compliance rates, so this asking the question, do you meditate anymore? And I thought this was pretty important to what you were saying, because it's like, did you continue integrating something in your life at a later term point when you weren't involved with this program anymore? And the numbers are pretty impressive here. 6 months later, number still meditating 77%, and out to 1 year, still over 50%. Now, this is hard. Any program we deliver, you know, you're trying to get people to exercise or eat better or all the million types of ways in which we try to improve lifestyle. We know that after about 3 months, people move on with their lives and they do other things. I tend to think after someone has been in a mindfulness training program, the varieties, MBSR and others, there's still something that is carried regardless of whether they're going to be doing it every day. Do you agree with that? And what are people carrying?
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And in those follow-up papers, that's what we were trying to actually get at. Was, is there something here that you suspect is of lasting value? And can you help us understand what it is? Because we don't know. But how is this 3 years out, 4 years out? You know, what's your relationship with your breath? And does awareness of breathing in everyday life, we called it AOB, awareness, AOBDL, awareness of breathing in everyday life. And we would just ask people, how much do you practice that? And because that's as much a part of the meditation practice as doing a body scan for 45 minutes. And it turned out that people were practicing AOBDL 4 years later after an 8-week intervention. And reporting also when we asked them, how meaningful looking back do you feel that those 8 weeks were for you? I mean, is this something came and went, or is this had some kind of lasting value, enduring value or meaning? And the vast majority of people were saying, you know, I got something from that. It's really hard to put into words maybe, but I got something. And what they'll often will say is, you know what I got out of it? I got my breathing out of it. Well, wait a minute. You were breathing long before you came to the stress reduction program. What do you mean you got your breathing? Or you learned about the breathing? And I think what they mean is that they woke up to the fact that awareness is incredibly powerful, and that it's like what one of my early patients called an, I don't play golf, so I don't remember the exact thing that he said, but it's in Full Catastrophe Living. He said, like, it's a special club in my golf club bag, that he had another iron in that he could use in particular situations. And that's exactly how health develops, is that you feel like you have more, going back to Bandura, self-efficacy. You have more agency. You have more of a capacity to actually be in wiser, less self-destructive relationship with the unwanted and the painful. And I consider that to be kind of verging on wisdom.
And there was an element to this.
And that's certainly self-regulation, right?
Yeah. And that point you were making about that measure, AOBDL, looking at this paper, the nuance to that point was 4 years out, they were reporting that that form of breathing was very useful to their coping. So they were still attaching that to the challenges that they were facing in their life. And that was over 54% reporting that. And that's 4 years later. I'm surprised that people even remember they took a behavioral program 4 years before. So this is impressive. It's like something is lasting. And I think, you know, people struggle with identifying, like you're saying, what that is. There's like a flavor to human consciousness, the depth of awareness, which then becomes accessible. It's like people pass a threshold to recognize the breadth of the human experience. And, you know, we turn off to it, but then we come back and we still know it's there. You know, we know it's like when my cousin, he's taking up, he heard us in our last discussion and he's calling me saying, hey, I'm going to get back into meditation. He's like, I always knew it was there. Mm-hmm. And I know the importance of it. I'm just not using it, but I feel that it needs to be in my life. And so what is that?
So you can say to him, next time you talk to him, you can say, it's not exactly correct to say that it's there. Mm-hmm. You might find it more helpful if you say that it's here. Mm-hmm. If you chop the T off the there, because the present moment is what people are really talking about, that we discover through mindfulness that we're alive only in this moment. So that has a lot of ramifications, because it's like if you are feeling plagued by anything, an event, a stressful event or a thought or an emotion, and you have this extra way of holding it in awareness that gives you more degrees of freedom to not react, but to just respond. And a response might be just keep breathing and let it come and let it go, because it will obey the law of impermanence just like everything else. Then you don't have to make it into my anxiety or my pain. It's bad enough that it's pain, but when it's my pain, you've got a whole other level of cognition and meaning associated to it that actually is very damaging. And I cited Beecher's World War II studies on the Anzio beachhead where people had, you know, their bodies blown apart, and they were saying that they weren't in pain. And he couldn't understand that until he kind of grokked that this was their ticket home out of the war zone. And no matter how much damage they had, they were so happy to be out of the war zone that something that you would consider to be intolerable to actually experience, they were saying it's no big deal. Now, that of course, that was in the shock of battle and so forth, but still, it tells you that the mind has a role to play here in terms of our experience of anything, not just pain or suffering, and that we have a lot of degrees of freedom in navigating the ups and downs of it, but only if you're in the present moment, because that's the only moment that it's here, that you're here. And so this becomes a kind of art form where you can basically befriend yourself and then also befriend stillness, silence. You don't have to fill every one of your moments with something, including checking your notifications on your supercomputer cell phone, or be lost in the kind of rabbit holes of social media, because you're already whole and already complete. And then it doesn't mean you can't use social media, but you'll use social media with a kind of different way of being in relationship to the fact that if you're already complete, you don't really need any of this stuff. And that's the root meaning of the word health is whole, W-H-O-L-E. So that's really, in a sense, a way to be healthy moment by moment. And when you get thrown, panic disorder, panic attack, all those kinds of things that the papers were, you know, interrogating, you're like, okay, I can actually be with the panic attack. I can ride the wave of the panic in the same way as I would ride the wave of my breath coming in. And I can actually see the panic. It's got sensations in the belly, like butterflies or contraction, and in the shoulders and in the jaw. And it also has like thoughts in the mind that are terrifying. And none of that is actually me. The awareness can hold it all without personalizing it. And then all of a sudden, it's like being surfing on a wave. You go up and then you come back down. And you can, you know, even a wave of, we never talked about this, but people would come in and say after 4 or 5 weeks of MBSR, I quit smoking. And so we haven't even mentioned smoking. What are you doing quitting smoking? And he said, well, I decided to just sort of bring mindfulness to lighting up a cigarette and then breathing it in. And I realized, I don't like the taste of it. I don't like what is the feeling of it in my lungs. And then I don't like the look on my fingers and all of this kind of stuff. And it was kind of a spontaneous way of recognizing that the agency we were talking about, or the latitude of options that we have when we recognize that thoughts are just thoughts, emotions are just emotions, sensations are just sensations, and we don't build them into the narrative of my life is over, I'm a complete failure, I'll be in pain for like this for the rest of my life. Well, that's a future prediction, and no one's good at predicting the future. So what about back to the present moment? And then all of a sudden, you've got this new way of navigating or surfing or threading your way through life in ways that are profoundly illuminating, rejuvenating, and promote what people nowadays, no one would have used this term back then, but flourishing. Of course, that's kind of like a takeoff on Aristotle's eudaimonia. So it's been around for a very long time, but every generation in some sense has to rediscover it for themselves. And I think this is how the scientific process actually works. And we need to continually relanguage things and keep asking ourselves, what were we missing? What we were so intoxicated by the positive results that we found. What were we actually missing? And I think the last thing I'll say is like that in a certain sense, what we're seeing with that 4 years out, and you're asking them about awareness of breath in daily life. And they say, oh yeah, that's really important to me. This is kind of in the present day vocabulary, I'd say we're shifting the default mode from mindlessness and mind wandering to embodied wakefulness in the present moment. We're slowly shifting. Now, I don't know if the neuroscience will ever show that or not, but the default mode network, okay, is really associated with all sorts of things that are a strain on the organism in a certain way. And when the default mode network quiets down, well, then you're more at home. And when you see that the default mode network is just narrative, this is one thing after, it's just one damn thing after another. But who's attending to the narrative, or who's even secreting the narrative? That's another very deep question. But now I think the neuroscience, that confluence of neuroscience with these contemplative traditions, not just MBSR and MBCT, but on a lot of different levels, are really giving us a new kind of lease on asking deep questions about medicine and psychology, for one thing, but not just for the individual, but for society, and not just for society, but for the planet. And I think there's a certain urgency to it that's huge.
And I've written with something similar with colleagues about transdiagnostic processes. And it speaks to the work that you did. And I'm going to move us to the 1988 paper in the Journal of Behavioral Medicine, when you started to examine multiple types of conditions, right? So in technical terms, transdiagnostic is a good fit because it's still on the like illness category side, the disease side, but it says something, it speaks to something that perhaps there are universals underlying human suffering. I think that was well known, but those universals are now being placed in what you would call technical or scientific empirical terms. Going back to our conversation on self-regulation, like what are the underlying features that make humans feel unwell? And part of that is like dysregulated attention, volatile affect, where people some moments feel great and then they feel terrible the next moment. And so if you kind of quantify people along that spectrum, you say maybe there are some universals underlying what make people feel not at ease. And so in this study, you titled it Compliance with an Outpatient Stress Reduction Program. I found this one very interesting because the diversity of types of conditions that were included, and this would be something in the scientific world we would call external validity or generalizability of what your program was offering. And I think maybe this was the first study to say, hey, this isn't about the pain clinic, as you're mentioning. This is about underlying features of not feeling great. And so in the study, you had, you know, your pain cohort, all different types of pain, low back pain, headache, chest, abdominal, upper and lower extremity, and then added a stress cohort. So people, look how diverse this is, hypertension, heart attack history, anxiety, GI disorders, sleep disorders. So did you find, so this was a kind of a broad clinic assessment. What was going on here? Was this just the all comers and you were doing an analysis of all comers at the clinic?
Yeah, we were trying to look at, you know, compliance in that paper. This is the 1988 paper with,
yes,
right? You know, the compliance of a patient to a doctor's visit when the doctor initiates the referral is, I cite it in the paper. I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's actually quite low. So we were, that's with one doctor's visit that's, you know, initiated by the doctor. And we were interested in, well, what is actually going on with the compliance for all these, because in those days it was all by physician referral, people being referred to the clinic. And so, I'll just go to that paper. Actually, I have it here someplace.
I As you're looking, I found it quite interesting.
This is the figure one, right? On page 341, this is what
which is impressive.
This was really important to me because, you know, we wanted to look at, okay, this is all by physician referral. And so how many of the people that are referred by their doctor, even how many are referred? Okay, so we had 1,155 people who were referred. And then we lost 25% of them. So we only got 869 in for an interview. Okay, and we interviewed everybody in the old days. Now that, you know, isn't cost effective anymore, unfortunately, because those interviews were an incredibly important part of this whole thing. Because it was one teacher meeting with one person, and you could really, we listened to their stories. And just ask what brings you to stress reduction, and you know, so an open-ended question, and then we just listened and let people talk, and almost never have that experience in the hospital. So it was a very powerful intervention in its own right. On the basis of the interviews, we got, I think, 90% of the people in. So you know, they enrolled 748 out of the 869 enrolled. And then the question is, okay, you say you're going to start, but how many actually started? And there we lost another 10% or so. So it goes down from, you know, in the stepwise function to 715. But of those 715 that started, we had 598 completed, which is like a huge number of people completing an 8-week, very highly demanding program. That was telling me something about what people are capable of, especially medical patients with long-term chronic conditions, the average chronicity being about 8 years, pain, stress, illness of every kind. And we're only losing like 50, I think it's, what was it?
Yeah, so I am, John, from a way, I'm extremely impressed. So, and I'll tell you why I'm impressed with these numbers. And it's something that we're still learning from. And I'll connect this to a model we currently use in a lot of our grants. But so you just have a referral system in place. And the doctors, the physicians, they tell their patients, which is common, hey, we have this program, please use it. And you can contact them. You lose a huge amount of people in that moment. This was had nothing to do with your program. This has to do with any time you make a recommendation. And the fact that actually people who completed your program that went all the way from just the referral in a healthcare delivery system to actually completing an intensive program is over 50% is shocking to me. And the reason I say that, because now, and I wanted to bring this up as part of the arc of scientific discovery, we currently write in, so I just submitted a grant proposal, the implementation science feature of when we are planning a trial, we have to look to the future and have a plan about how we integrate the healthcare delivery system if we do indeed find an effect holds. You were doing this as part of your program, which is major kudos on your part, because we still struggle. We have something called like the REAIM framework that is kind of really pulled together clearly guidelines for how to bring in the early adopters, who's going to represent the program, how are you going to get the physicians on board? You were doing that built in to the research program at the time and really interested in these questions that we just now are, for the last decade, have been really trying to build in as part of implementation science, because we realize if we spend all the resources to run these trials, and if we do find the effects, we have to have a plan in place to make that referral system work. And this is hard. So that's why I'm saying 50% is a lot to make it through an intensive program. So something was working well here. There's a lot of lessons to be learned.
I think so. I think that there are a lot of lessons to be learned from these kinds of results, because it's like, how do we actually reach people and ignite passion for them in what Facebook has destroyed the word, but in engagement? You know, we need them to be engaged, but not with their phones or with Facebook, but need them to be engaged with the with the adventure of being human and being in a body and having the kinds of problems that bodies have and the kinds of problems that minds have under certain kinds of circumstances. And motivation becomes absolutely key to engagement. That if we can get people motivated, they think that there's something they can do for themselves that no one on the planet can do for them, and they'll do it with a group of people. Part of the beauty of the mindfulness-based programs is that it's not a therapy. I mean, it's a class, and with a large class with 30, sometimes 40 people in it. And you look around the room and you see all the different people in there. And we go around the room and they say why they're there in the first class. And you hear what people are dealing with. And no matter what you're dealing with, you go, oh my God, I'm glad I'm not dealing with what he's dealing with. So there's a certain way in which you become really respectful of the human condition and how much suffering there is in the world and how inspiring we can be to each other. So that when one person who has chronic pain comes in the second class or the third class and reports on their pain being much less than when they were practicing the body scan, all the people who didn't have that experience in the first week or two are listening and say, holy cow, if he could experience that in 2 weeks, maybe I should pay more attention to the body scan, you know, if I'm doing it kind of on autopilot or something like that, rather than giving it my full attention. And this is, I think, a way in which there wasn't one, I think I said this the last time we spoke, there wasn't one teacher in the room. There were as many teachers in the room as there were people in the room, because we're all constantly learning from each other. When you set up the conditions in a way to amplify people's motivation and intentionality for healing, let's say, and minimize the kind of things that go on in one's own mind that are always subverting our intentions. And that's an art form. It really is an art form, and how you inspire people to do this. But once you get people into the room the first time and you send them off with homework and they come back, then you've pretty much got everybody. You're going to lose most people in the first week or two, because once they start hearing what is going on with each other, they don't want to miss the next class, because I have too much, you know, kind of invested in what Mrs. So-and-so is going to come back and say, because I was touched in a certain way. And that's a way in which I think, especially for behavioral interventions or whatever, you know, psychological interventions of any kind that are group-based, that it winds up in some sense being a lesson on belonging in life and not being that different from anybody else, but actually having a repertoire of interior resources that we're not even taught in school, that we have all these different ways of being and ways of knowing that can be exercised, that can be practiced, that can be developed, and that have strong biological effects and brain effects.
So you bring up a really important thing, John. It's motivation and behavioral intervention. And your program, probably I had labeled it as intensive, because as my cousin recently said, I can't believe I just sat there for 45 minutes and pulled it off. He couldn't believe in his own ability to be motivated and intentional. And for us who've have done MBSR, various iterations, gone to retreats, we may take this for granted that someone new to this may sit down and in a way be terrified of time itself. And maybe my last question to you about motivation has to do with early on in the program, since you have taught this in so many ways with so many people, what is the motivational element to capitalize on to keep those, to try to keep the largest group of people possible? Because you said some will drop. Is there a language to use? Is there an approach? Because this is hard. I know it's a hard question.
This is where the teacher comes in a very big way. This is not, we're not talking about an app. Yes, there are mindfulness apps and everything else, and they can potentially be quite useful. But that's more practice-based where, you know, everything is like, but when you're in a room with people, or even a Zoom room, I guess, you know, if it, you know, we're forced more and more into that. But when you're in a room with people and you're the teacher, the most important element of what you can contribute is yourself, your own being. And when you make eye contact with somebody, when you listen to them, when they feel that you're 100% there and not just half there listening to them while you're monitoring everybody else in the room or anything else, they feel met. They feel seen. And there's nothing that human beings want, desire, and feel good about than being seen, being met. And even a very small dose of it can go a very, very long way. But the person who's doing it, the teacher, can't do it to get an effect, can't do it because that makes other people feel good. It has to be completely authentic. It has to be like the real caring, like health care. It helps if, you know, you care, you know, like Peabody said, you know, the secret of patient care is caring for the patient. But caring really involves presencing. And presencing is mindfulness in action. So you have to live this. This is why the training of MBSR teachers and MBC teachers is so important, because you can't just follow a script or do it out of a book. You can't be like anybody else. You can't imitate your hero of the moment, your meditative or yogic hero. You have to be real. And these people may be in chronic pain or have all sorts of medical conditions, but they have very high bullshit detectors, and they can pick up in a nanosecond when you're not being authentic. So, and I saw that big time when we started teaching MBSR in prisons, because they are really into hustles. So they can tell a hustle a mile off because they're all like supreme, you know, world-class hustlers. And when you're authentic, even about your being afraid, it brings out something heartful in the other. It's like the ultimate human connection, belonging. And then we're all part of, like, you could say tribalism is a real scourge. It's a disease. But not if we're all part of the same tribe. Then there's just recognition. And then there's, like, as I was saying, he thinks I'm capable of this, or she thinks I'm capable of this. A lot of people will tell you, you know, not since second grade has anybody thought I was capable of anything. If this person in authority thinks I'm capable of this, maybe I should see if I'm capable of this. What do I have to lose? That's why people come back. They come back because it becomes an adventure, not one cognitive behavioral exercise after another that they have to be good at. It's not a cognitive behavioral intervention. I mean, that would be the kiss of death for MBSR, to turn it into something like that. So there's what some people call, like Becca Crane and the people in Bangor, North Wales, and so forth, and also the Oxford Center for Mindfulness people. Excuse me. They talk about the explicit curriculum and the implicit curriculum. And the implicit curriculum is that embodied presence. You can't be somebody else, but you sure better be yourself. And that doesn't mean some kind of perfectionist front that you put on. So sometimes it's going to look very vulnerable. Sometimes it's going to look uncertain, but it will be real and people will feel that. And then you have to also titrate yourself so that you don't become the center of attraction, you know, and it's all about the teacher. That would be also extremely toxic. So it really means the teacher has to embody wakefulness, mindfulness, not fake it, embody it, not in some kind of idealized perfection, but as good enough for this moment. And this is kind of an art form. And it's really, you know, one of the ways I spend my energy nowadays is spending a lot of time with MBSR teachers and groups of MBSR teachers around the world, cultivating these very concerns, these very questions of how to be authentic and not just kind of do some kind of scripted curriculum of MBSR that's not the real curriculum.
John, there, I should have ended on a last question, but now you got me really excited about a new question. So only value
one,
one
of the
more.
Risk factors of our conversations.
In a moment, say you're taking a music course to learn a new instrument, you are working with an art teacher, or you have the opportunity to be around a really good coach. In the moments that are kind of not able to be described, when you see their eyes squinting when they're trying to get something across, or you see them get lost in their own piece, it's, I feel what you say sometimes, and let me know if I'm correct or not. In those moments, there's the teaching. It's, they embodied the thing in full and they got lost almost in a way. And so is it that level where you're not conscious and you see, that's where it gets a little hard. Yeah. You get lost in the thing. And if the teacher is conscious or not, the lesson came across and the authenticity is absorbed immediately. Like, and it was beyond the teaching. Maybe it wasn't even intentional. Is that the thing, or is it something similar to the thing?
I'm not sure there's one thing. Mm-hmm. So I think all of that could be part of it, but it also could maybe not be part of it. Mm-hmm. It's not something that can be packaged. So everybody's going to be different and engage differently, really moment by moment by moment. So can you lose it in class? Yes, of course. You can lose your train of thought, or you could just say the wrong thing, or, you know, see what the effect of what you said is on another person on their face. And maybe not catch it until the class is over, and then the next day you realize it, or you wake up in the middle of the night, you realize it. But MBSR is, as I said before, is very forgiving. You can always come back the next time, and you know what? You can apologize, you can name something, you can explain, you can bring that into the practice itself and be completely honest about the fact that, like, I lost it, I blew it. And, you know, if the teacher can't lose it and blow it, then what is the message that's being sent to the participants in the class? That they have to be perfect? That would be absurd and really toxic. So these are really hard things to put into words, but I think that they've moved into the culture at the interface of where these meditative practices, these contemplative practices are converging with bioscience, psychology, neuroscience, and medicine in ways that we're beginning to, you know, understand and explore and discover. And I love that, it's one of the reasons I love having this conversation, that we don't have to get it, down to a formula, because it's the exact opposite that we're trying to do, is not reduce it all to a formula, but to understand that it's a very inclusive process that requires everybody to, in some sense, either be in their genius or be open to being a genius and just seeing what happens. And then even your pain and your symptoms of various kinds, they become allies in opportunities for learning, for entering into the present moment and seeing, well, what does this circumstance that I never wanted to be in, what can it actually teach me about not taking personally things that are not personal? no matter how much I am attempting, I mean, I'm tempted to take them personally, or I'm contracting into taking them personally and making it all about me. If one actually knows that it's not all about me in any small-minded way, then all of a sudden, the possibilities for coming to terms with the actuality of things, whether they're pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, it just expands like infinitely. And that's in a certain way what us human beings are capable of. I mean, we just haven't been taught that in school.
And so let's conclude on that, John.
Yeah,
that is a great way to end it on that big note. Thank you, Dr. Kabat-Zinn. Our listeners can find our recordings at goamra.org, goamra.org, or you can support us by becoming a member or subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.